It was a good moment. But all moments pass, and as they neared the camp, Thera's laughter trailed off. He glanced back and noted that she composed herself and put on a stern face. A commander's face. It wouldn't do for the fanatics to see the voice of their god being unserious. She hadn't needed to try, because when she saw the buzzard circling over the corpses piled outside the castle's quarter, Asher could tell it brought reality crashing back, abruptly ending whatever joy she'd felt along their ride. He slowed horse as they approached the camp. It was better not to startle a weary guard and have an arrow launched their way. A couple of somsak rose from the tall grass where they had been waiting in ambush. Even Ashok hadn't noticed their hiding places. Their vigilance pleased him. The camp was in good order. There were a few spots where blood had turned the ground to mud, but the soldiers Ashok had killed there had been carried down and thrown upon the corpse pile. The sons appeared upbeat and had gotten some rest. Their prisoners looked battered and surly, their wrists bound and tied to stakes driven into the ground. There were several strangers present, wearing insignia of various status, their expressions ranging from fearful to curious. "General!" Eklavya Karsawan came out to meet them. "And the Prophet! Welcome! How goes it in Havildar?"
"All is well here, Prophet. The sons are ready to serve."
"Good." Thera didn't wait for a hand to be offered, and instead just jumped off horse and landed lightly on her feet. Ashok suspected she liked to remind the sons that she, too, was warrior caste, and not some pampered furster.
"We've got much to do. The column will be here soon, and it's now 400 strong."
Ashok resisted the urge to shake his head at the use of the word strong.
"I see we have some guests."
"Yes, sir. Representatives from the various worker councils in Dakantar come to beg mercy so we don't pillage their town. Then some others saying they are part of Kita's rebellion."
"Have you confirmed they are who they claim to be?" Thera asked, which was a good question, considering how crafty the Inquisition was with their spies and infiltrators.
Eklavya spread his hands apologetically.
"Sorry, I have no idea how. I only knew the Keeper of Names for a few days, so I hid them and told them to keep quiet until the General got back. But they are not what I expected."
"Meaning?"
"They're whole men, not non-people."
The Havildar caught himself. But too late. All of the sons had been told of Thera's declaration that the castless were human too. Only Thera didn't seem to notice his mistake. It was one thing to insist on their personhood right after they were the pitiable victims of a terrible massacre, and quite another thing after a long day of the castless annoying her with their frivolous squabbles.
"I mean, they are men of status, supposed secret leaders of the rebellion who've been funding the faithful in secret."
Ashok knew very little about the real nature of Kita's rebellion or its participants, so that made him curious. These were far better at keeping their identity secret than most of the rebels the law had required him to deal with over the years. Thera must have been thinking the same thing.
"I know many of the rebels Kita has worked with, at least by name, but he kept most of them secret, even from me. Retul told him to keep things compartmentalized."
Of course a Lord Protector had known a thing or two about hunting down criminals.
"It takes longer when each captive you torture can only give up a couple of others, rather than the whole conspiracy," Ashok explained.
"I'll speak with the rebellion first, take the town's tribute second, and then we'll talk about what to do with the hostages last. We'll need privacy."
Thera glanced over at the command tent, which had belonged to the Fonto of the Chakmak garrison.
"Anyone using that fancy thing?"
"Not anymore."
Ashok had already noted that the previous owner was among the prisoners. One of the sons must have taken pity on the frail old man, because a cape had been put up on a few poles to provide him with shade. The Fonto was so elderly, he hardly even put up a fight when Ashok had captured him.
The same could not be said for his bodyguards, who had fought valiantly. Killing them seemed an unnecessary waste of honorable lives. But such was war.
The big tents where I told the rebels to wait for you so they could stay out of sight. I figured if we are going to ransom back these prisoners, it's no use them seeing our allies' faces, Eklavya said.
Jagdish had seen great potential in the intelligent young man, which was why he had picked him to be one of the Sun's leaders. Such wisdom indicated that Jagdish had been correct in his assessment.
Good thinking, Havildar.
Thera started walking toward the command tent.
General, would you accompany me?
Of course.
Ashok dismounted horse and turned the reins over to one of the Sons. It would be interesting to see what manner of lunatics Keita's preaching had attracted this time. Also, he needed to be there in case one of them turned out to be a secret inquisitor who'd tried to put a knife in the woman he was obligated to protect.
Please do not introduce me.
Why? Is the great Ashok Vidal still ashamed to be seen slumming it with criminals?
If they are assassins, I would prefer for them to be surprised when they learn I am no mere bodyguard.
Oh,
good point.
The interior of the captured command tent was entirely too nice. Soft rugs had been rolled upon the grass. There was a circle of pillows for the officers to sit on as they planned their strategy, and a wicker chair for the fronter that was throne-like in its proportions. The incense and perfumes were thick enough to drown out the stink of horse soldiers. It was more like entering a fine home than a tent, so much so that the waiting fanatics had even reflexively taken their shoes off at the entrance. There were two pairs of sturdy work shoes and a pair of slippers decorated with bits of ivory.
Living in such comfort, no wonder that old man was so easy to capture, Ashok muttered as they walked inside.
I've missed comfort. Thera gave a low whistle. I say we keep it.
Such opulence is unbecoming your warrior caste.
I'm in my own unique caste of one now. It stands to reason religious figureheads should have a fancy tent.
Ashok studied her curiously. Apparently she was being serious. The keeper constantly preaches about the unfairness of the high status having all the wealth while the lesser get nothing. What would Keita say about that?
Right now, I don't rightly care. That's his thing. I want to sleep on pillows again. Ashok shrugged. He knew Keita was just making up all this religious nonsense as he went along anyway. However, he did not like the idea of claiming this tent. Even outside of the law, Ashok still preferred things to be consistent. But it was not his decision to make. She raised her voice to address the waiting men, who had not noticed them come in.
I am Thera Vane.
The Prophet!
Then all of them immediately went to their knees, bowing like she was the Thakur of their house, the bearer of the Ancestor Blade, and the Chief Judge, all rolled into one. Ashok could see now why Thera had tried so hard to keep her identity a secret from adversaries and sycophants both. With so many followers, it was no longer an option for her, but such piteous fawning behavior would quickly become tiresome.
I can tell this is going to be a long day.
Thera sighed as they kept their eyes averted.
All right, enough of that. I've got no time for foolishness. Stand up already.
As the men did, Ashok assessed them. Two were of the worker caste. The insignia on their sleeve that symbolized their particular duties were a mystery to him, but their rugged clothing was clean and new. The last, surprisingly, was of the highest caste, and had the insignia of a tax collector upon his colorful silk robes. Of course, the fanatics had worn their finest to meet the voice of their god. It was unknown what matter of tales these men had been told about Thera, but they seemed awestruck to be in her presence. When they came to their senses, they began babbling instructions, and then launched into the typical story of conspiracies and prophecies, and how they'd known all along the gods would return, so on and so forth. Their manner seemed sincere, except witch hunters were supposed to be phenomenal actors, too. Despite that, Ashok's gut told him he would not be needed to prevent any assassination attempts during this particular meeting. Regardless, he took up a position just to Thera's side, where he could immediately place his body between her and the fanatics. There he waited, scowling. To her credit, Thera managed to keep the surprise from her face, though it was obvious that she had not expected to find a member of the first cast here. In Locke, it was instinctive, reflexive even, to be submissive to your betters. Even defiant Thera, who had long since disregarded the law, obviously experienced a moment of trepidation before speaking to someone born of higher caste, so as to not give offense. Even if this one was a little older than a boy, thin and gangly, with a wispy excuse for a mustache. Regardless, rebellion was rare among those born to such lofty stations. That was probably why she let her visitors rattle off their introductory speeches before she cut them off. "Yes, I am the voice," though admitting it seemed to pain her. "I am honored by your greeting, and I'm glad to hear that those who've heard Keita's teachings have remained faithful. Only, I've not come to save you from the injustice of the capital right now. I'm just passing through with a column of refugees."
"We understand, mighty prophet, and it is we who have come bearing gifts for you," the tax collector proclaimed. "We were warned to be ready for the day you came here, and to have it prepared for you."
"Warned by who?"
"Mother Dawn," said one of the workers.
Now that got Ashok's attention. The odd woman who knew too much and travelled too fast always seemed to be preparing the way ahead of them in places they'd never intended to go. She'd appeared to Aklavia and the sons who had met them on the road to Haradas, and warned Toramana and his wild men that someday they would need to shelter the voice, years before Thera had even heard of the House of Assassins. To the workers, the Mother Dawn appeared to be a worker. To the warriors, a warrior, and when Ashok had met her in Jarlang, she had been a casteless. Thera looked to him, eyes narrowed. She was even more suspicious of the mysterious woman, or wizard, or creature, whatever she may be, than Ashok was. Thus far, Mother Dawn had aided them, but her ultimate purpose remained a mystery.
"What manner of gift did she tell you to bring me?"
500 rebel fighters, in position and prepared to seize the walls of Chakma at your signal."
Chapter 17. A vulture pecking at his bloody head woke him up.
"To the ocean with you,"
Baratas tried to say through cracked lips and a mouth dry as sawdust. All he could manage was an angry whisper.
"Go away! I'm still alive!"
The vulture seemed unsure of his claim, but it waddled off. After all, there was no shortage of easier carrion to feed upon nearby. Baratas found himself lying in the weeds, but better to be hidden in the grass than dead or a prisoner. He felt nothing but pain, until the memories of his brothers being killed one by one came rushing back. He had fought Ashok Vadal, and like 1,000 men before him, lost. His head hurt where the black heart had split it open, and a throbbing pain went out in a circle around the wound every time his heart beat. His helmet had saved his life, but the blow had rendered him useless. Upon checking the injury with one shaking hand, he found that the only thing holding a flap of his scalp down was dried blood. It was unknown how long he had been out. From his terrible thirst and muscles too stiff to move. Hours? A whole day? More?
He'd never been struck like this himself, but he knew from seeing it happen to others that it was hard to tell what a head wound bad enough to make a man's brain swell up would do to them. Ignoring the agony and dizziness, he managed to get to his knees so he could see over the grass. An experienced raider, he kept his movements slow, so as to not catch a sentry's eye. Except there was no one left to hide from. It appeared they'd broken camp and moved out. Any faint hope he might have held that his people had turned things around and claimed victory was dashed when he saw the pile of bodies wearing the tan and green uniforms of Great House Akershan. Weary, he sunk back down, and even that movement made him nauseous. If there'd been any water left in his body, he would have vomited. Paratus knew he was a good swordsman, perhaps one of the very best in all of Akershan. Yet he'd been nothing but a temporary distraction to Ashok Fadal. None of them had. And when Paratus thought of his dead brothers, an angry determination filled him, and he began to crawl. Ashok's men, whoever they were, had looted the Akashani camp, taking the food, weapons, tents, horses, and tack, and probably carried it all off in the cumbersome wagons their elderly Fonto insisted on bringing. As much as he disliked the old man, his safety had been Baratas's obligation, and now he was either dead or a hostage. Anger turned to fury as he dragged himself through the dirt by his fingernails. This insult would not stand. Paratus found that though the enemy had stolen most of their gear, they'd not taken all of it. The wineskins had been drained and discarded, but he found a canteen on the belt of a dead man that was still half full of water. He drank it slowly, lying there and plotting his revenge, until the dizziness passed enough for him to stand. On wobbly legs, he could now see that Dakantar hadn't been put to the torch, but neither had the castless quarter. He needed to get the Chakma to warn the rest of the garrison about Ashok's rebels, but he'd never make it across the plains on foot in time. He had the status to go down there and demand the workers lend him a horse, but he'd be sure to be seen by the fish-eaters, and he doubted his caste was very popular in Dakantar right now. Surely the non-people knew that they were all supposed to have been killed. They would be in a bloodthirsty mood. In his current, weakened state, even the skinniest castless could take him. From the bloat and flies and what was left of his friends and colleagues, Baratas realized he'd been unconscious for a day and a half. Odds were that Curdan had been seized too, or she'd run off thinking him killed, and was long gone. But now that his lips were moist enough, it was worth a try. So he whistled for his horse. When there was no response, Baratas cursed and set out toward Chakma, knowing that he would more than likely never make it. He was dehydrated, hungry, had lost too much blood, and as the sun fell, the temperature would drop. Except Baratas was no quitter. His burning hatred for Ashok Fadal would have to sustain him. He walked and walked, falling occasionally because of feet that didn't want to work right. Whenever he fell down, he would tell himself that he was merely stopping to rest, because to admit otherwise was weak. Whenever he got back up, he would look back toward Dakantar to see how far he'd gone. Not far enough. Then give a sharp whistle in the vain hopes that the winds would carry the familiar sound to wherever Curdan was, before going back to his march. Once he fell, and must have passed out because when he woke up again it was dark. This time it wasn't a buzzard's beak on his face, but rather a vast, soft nose. As a law-fearing man, Baratas did not believe in miracles. But he did not have any other word sufficient to describe seeing Curdan standing protectively over him.
Paratus rode for 3 days, though he barely remembered them. It was a blur of grass and sun. He spent most of the journey semi-conscious in the saddle, but Cadan knew the way back to her home pastures. Occasionally, he'd wake up on the ground, having fallen off, unsure how much time had passed, with his noble horse waiting patiently for him. She probably even kept the buzzards and wolves away. She was a good girl, so loyal that if he died here, she'd probably wait there until there was nothing left but his skeleton, before sadly moving on. His saddlebags had supplies for the journey. If she had been captured, Ashok's rebels hadn't even had a chance to pick through his belongings before she had heeded his call and escaped. Or perhaps she had simply gone off to graze until he'd needed her. Either way, there was Nan, dried strips of goat meat, and a wine bladder full enough to get him part of the way back to Chakma. He'd also had a small bottle of potent sundar, but rather than drink it to dull the pain, he'd used it to make the pain worse by washing the gash on his head in the hopes the alcohol would keep it from getting infected. Then he'd wrapped his head in bandages to keep the flies off it and hoped for the best. Long ago, his uncle Vikram had been obligated to the Historian's Order and promoted to the first caste. When he had come home to visit family, Vikram had seen in young Bharatas a sharp mind and intense dedication, and thus tried to recruit him for service in the capital. Only Bharatas's father would have none of that nonsense. They were riders of the plains, not guarders of the walls. Proud and swift, his son was intended for greater things than guarding a museum. He'd not even been able to guard a crusty fonto from criminals. If his father could see him now, he'd kill himself because of the shame. He should have taken Uncle Vikram up on his offer. There were a great many more warriors in Chakma. They were supposed to watch the caste list there, but not make a move against them until the fonto returned to personally oversee the extermination. He hadn't wanted anyone else to be able to claim any glory. Bharatas had been forced to hide his disgust at the time, as if there was glory to be found in killing helpless fish-eaters. Well, at least they'd all thought they would be helpless until they'd somehow routed some of Akashan's finest. This was all Ashok Vidal's fault. Bharatas vowed that after he warned the rest of the Chakma garrison, and he was well enough to travel the great distance to Mat Darvo, he would personally tell the Thakur about Ashok's crimes and ask for the aid of the bearer of their ancestor blade. Ashok was good, but he would be no match for the legendary sword Akasalem, which was said could take all 4 legs off an armored horse in 1 swing. Bharatas felt no shame in losing to a bearer. It would take another ancestor blade to beat an ancestor blade. Come to think of it, ancestor blades were supposed to be made of black steel that devoured the sunlight and stung the eye to look at. Though the fight remained hazy in his mind, Bharatas didn't remember seeing anything like that. Even though it had been lightning quick in his hands, Ashok had been using what appeared to be a regular sword. And if he was that terrifying of an opponent without an ancestor blade, the man was a monster. Bharatas was a fighter, not a tactician, so he'd never paid much attention to the lesser duties of the logistics corps until he needed them. But he always memorized where the supply station was in the region he was serving. There was one between Dakantar and Chakma, where he would be able to get his head stitched up and refill his saddlebags. Cardan was doing fine. There was plenty of water from the spring runoff, and she grazed whenever he passed out, which was often. Except when he found the station, it had been ransacked. The water tank had been punctured and drained. The rations had been stolen. Whatever the raiders couldn't carry, they'd burned, including the haystacks. Judging by the lukewarm ashes, they were at least 30 days ahead of him. The handful of warriors who were supposed to be manning the place were missing. Judging by the tracks, they'd been quickly overwhelmed and captured by a group of about 30 horsemen.
It angered him that there wasn't even any blood spilled. They'd not even put up a fight. It was a slight detour off the main route to Chakma, and located in a gully so it wouldn't have been visible over the horizon. How had the rebels known about this place? Had they found it by accident? Unlikely on the vast plains. Or had someone betrayed them? There had been talk about Akashani warriors joining the rebels' cause, but Baratas had dismissed those rumors as foolishness. Now he was not so sure. The idea that some of his people would fall in with fanatics disgusted him. No, it was more likely the local castlers had known about it. They were idiot savages, but they weren't blind. He'd not cared for their orders. Slaughtering castlers seemed like a pointless waste. Yes, there were rebels among them. Baratas had fought criminals before, but he knew most of the castlers were too stupid and lazy to rebel. Killing such defenseless wretches was beneath their dignity, and most of his brothers felt the same. But the arrival of the Black Heart would change everything. That would be a proper war. Even though he was injured, delirious, and had just suffered a terrible defeat, the thought energized Baratas. Regardless of how low his rebels were, the army that defeated Ashok Vidal would become legend. If their bearer wouldn't kill Ashok, then Baratas vowed that he would find a way to destroy the Black Heart himself.
Faster, Kudan, to Chakma.
The next day, he found his home city at war. Chapter 18.
I will cut a path, Ashok bellowed at the Sons of the Black Sword. On me!
Shoulder to shoulder and three ranks deep, the Akashani heavy spearmen filled the entire street, their weapons leveled and ready as they quick-marched forward. Their armor was made of chain and green lacquered plate, their footsteps in practiced time. They made for an imposing force. Nothing at all like the loose clusters of surprised warriors they'd cut down to make it this far into the heart of Chakma. The Sons of the Black Sword ran to keep up as Ashok charged the center of that steel wall. The soldiers seemed surprised, surely wondering what manner of madman would willingly impale himself on their spears. The closest to thrust with an accuracy that would have caught any normal man in the ribs, but with the inhuman strength stolen from the heart of the mountain, he smashed the attacks aside. Poles splintered. He dodged another point and rolled between the shafts, swinging his sword. That hit clean beneath the helm. A warrior fell, blood spraying from his neck. Ashok turned into the next and kicked, shattering a knee. As that spearman dropped, Ashok vaulted over him and struck at the next. He'd made a hole. As the second rank tried to plug it, the howling, battle-mad Sons rushed to exploit it. Ashok made it wider for them. Outside a few feet, a spear made for a fearsome weapon. Inside that radius, however, its length became a liability. So Ashok went to work. Laying about him with his sword, he kept pushing, staying as close to the enemy as possible, crashing into them, denting helmets with his elbows or cracking skulls with his hardened fists. Anyone he knocked down would be easy to finish by the Sons behind him. He could not feel fear, but he could recognize it on the faces of other men. From the look of these poor warriors, Ashok must have made a terrifying figure. Per Therma's command, to do his best to remain alive, he had worn the protector armor that Gutch had repaired and fitted for him. Except Ashok could not stand the indecency of a criminal like him wearing the symbol of the law. So he had removed the face, and rather than shame the proud colors of his former order, he had blackened the silver with soot and ash, so that instead of a shining beacon of the law, he had become darkness incarnate, black as a demon. The tall brick walls had fallen before the city had even known it was under attack.
The rebels had seized the towers and flung open the gates for them. The sons had ridden inside as all of Chakma had descended into chaos. The rebels were fighting house to house, getting revenge against any who they'd felt had wronged them. And from the amount of bloodshed in this place, that had been a great many wrongs indeed. All this law-breaking disgusted him, but he had a mission to complete. Seize the first caste district and the government house to force their surrender. Ashok caught a spear in his free hand the instant before it would have impaled him. He sidestepped and yanked the spear forward, jerking the warrior off balance. The handguard of his sword broke jaw and teeth. Another warrior was battling one of the sons, and Ashok took advantage of that temporary distraction by slicing a leg out from beneath him. A moment later, the son smashed a mace down on the fallen man's head. Most of the city's warriors had been taken by surprise, but the Paltons stationed at their garrison nearest the first caste quarter had come out ready to fight. Rather than blunder out in small groups to try and stop the rampaging rebels like most stationed here, this Rizaldar had taken the time to organize, armor up, and stick together. They'd marched to the street that allowed entrance to the estates of their highest status men. Now that same sharp Rizaldar was behind his heavy infantry, riding back and forth on a horse so his men could see him, shouting for them to hold the line, even as the Somsek kept launching crossbow bolts at him. There was already one bolt that had failed to penetrate, sticking out of his breastplate, but he still refused to dismount because his men needed to see him. Ashok knew they would probably have to kill that officer before this was over, but in the meantime, he had earned Ashok's respect. The sons kept pushing into the gap, swinging swords, axes, and hammers. They took advantage of the violence Ashok caused, even as he spread far more, darting between the defenders, slashing and striking. Though they'd fought wizards and demons, and ambushed many soldiers, this was the sons' first stand-up battle. They did not disappoint. Jagdish would have been proud of his fanatics. All Ashok could do was fight as hard as he could to keep the sons alive. Steel rebounding off his lamellar plate, he crashed forward, spreading chaos among the ranks, shoving armored warriors into each other, keeping them off balance, bounding back and forth, preventing them from organizing a good defense, and killing, always killing. Each time a warrior slipped, Ashok took advantage of it, and another man died. If he'd still had Angruvadal, they'd all be dead already. The sons flowed in around him, stabbing and crushing. There were tall buildings on both sides of them, and as the sons took the middle, the spearmen's ranks were cut in half, and each half was pressed against the walls. Jagdish would have yelled at them for that, because it meant they were now surrounded on three sides. But this had degenerated into something so savage that there was no real strategy at all. The enemy Rizaldar was screaming for his back rank to drop their spears and draw their swords. But then a bolt hit his mount in the neck, and the horse and rider went crashing to the stone. They were winning, but Ashok saw that reinforcements were running up behind the enemy. These weren't even real warriors, just a mob of sepoys, worker caste militia who could be called up and issued weapons in the direst emergencies. They were unarmored and unskilled, but numbers could make the difference. Eklavia was at Ashok's elbow, battering the enemy with a warhammer. The young man was obviously frightened, but in the moment, too determined to feel it. There was a flicker of movement, the briefest of warning that any normal man would have failed to see, but Ashok reached back with his free hand for the spear that had been flung at his Havildar, and caught it with only inches remaining between the blade and Eklavia's spine. He swung it around, broke the shaft in half over a warrior's head, and then hurled the rest end over end into another man's chest. Ashok knew he should not have been able to react so quickly on his own. Once again, it was almost as if Angruvadal was still with him, whispering. Did the shard lodged in his heart still live? There was no time for such idle ponderings, though, so he grabbed Eklavia by his shoulder plate and spun him around. Havildar!
Yes, General.
The wide-eyed warrior didn't even know that Ashok had just saved him from being paralyzed from the neck down.
Break down those doors. Send archers up the stairs. Fire down into the enemy. Yes, sir.
Eklavya ran back, shouting commands. Ashok returned to the fight. The faster he could beat these warriors, the sooner the city would fall and Thera could order the rebels to stand down, the more lives spared. Though he was unsure if once released, the rebels' bloodlust could be so easily stopped. As if to accentuate this thought, there was a sharp crack of thunder, as somewhere nearby a rebel unleashed illegal fortress magic. Backs to the brick, the Akashani warriors fought desperately, but it wasn't enough to stop the brutal assault of the Suns, and the enemy began to fall apart. Above them, curtains were flung open as the archers of the wild men took up position. On this flat street, beyond the line of colliding and moving men, their targets had been limited for fear of hitting their brothers. With a bit of elevation, however, their choices must have seemed endless. Bowstrings thrummed. More Akashani warriors fell. The sepoys ran forward, carrying cheap short swords that must have felt unfamiliar and clumsy in their hands. The blades were even speckled with rust, probably because they'd been long forgotten and locked up in some storage room. Normally, when the bell rang to summon these workers, it was to fight fires. Being handed a sword instead of a bucket must have confused and frightened them. It almost made Ashok sad to have them killed. Ashok broke past the last of the warriors and launched himself directly at the sepoys. A few of them yelped, turned, and fled when they saw him. The brave ones kept coming. Ashok simply cut the leader's head off. The body managed to run a few more feet past him before falling over and dumping what to the workers must have seemed a ridiculous amount of blood. The workers skidded to a stop. The head landed between them.
Flee, or I will kill you all!
The drafted workers must have believed the terrifying, blood-soaked, black-clad apparition, because they all turned and ran for their lives. That problem solved, Ashok turned back to the battle. The Akashani were overwhelmed and crumbling. One of their Havildars was shouting for a retreat. Shekhar of the Somsak leaned way out one of the upstairs windows to launch a crossbow bolt directly into that warrior's head. The command had caught the attention of many of the warriors, and having the word retreat punctuated with its issuer's immediate death, broke them. Men fled. Others tossed down their weapons and begged for mercy. Swords and hammers were raised.
Let them live!
Ashok bellowed. The Sons heard him. Mostly. Something warned him to turn and lift his sword. Sure enough, the enemy Rizaldar was coming at Ashok, curved sword moving in a blur. Ashok met it, steel on steel, then swiftly turned into the man to violently shoulder him to the ground. There was no mistaking it that time. That blade should have struck him in the back. That instinct had been Ungruvadal's gift. Like during the duel against Bondit, or bringing him back to life on Sikasso's meat hook, it was plain now the shard in his heart intended to keep him alive by once again granting him the instincts of all its previous bearers. That was huge. Amidst all the carnage, Ashok laughed. There was not time to ponder on the ramifications of Ungruvadal's gift, because the warrior was getting back to his feet.
Surrender, Rizaldar. You are defeated. And let you rebels destroy Chakma? Never!
Ashok could have easily killed him on the way up, but he did not wish to.
We will not raise this city, nor will we execute your men. You have my word.
The Rizaldar extended his sword before him, ready to attack.
What worth is the word of a criminal? When the criminal is Ashok Vidal, it is worth everything.
The Rizaldar flinched.
Ashok Vidal? I am.
Better to sword fight a wildfire.
The warrior looked like he was ready to die and would go to the great nothing without a regret, as befitted his caste. But then he looked to his men and saw their sorry state.
It was easy for a warrior to think of his own glory, and harder to set it aside for the safety of others. This one was brave, but their battle was lost. Best to save who he could.
Do you promise you'll let my men live?
They will be ransomed back to your house when your Thakor agrees to spare the castless.
It was what Thera had decided to do with all the other prisoners they had taken so far. Ashok saw no reason why she would decide differently here.
Until then you will be bound, but neither starved nor tortured.
He glanced toward the impressive government buildings behind them.
What of Chakma's first caste?
Their fate will be theirs to decide. They can be proud, or they can survive.
The offer was fair, the stakes high. It was a difficult choice, but the wiser one was made. The Rizaldar nodded in submission, and then placed his sword on the ground at Ashok's feet.
Chapter 19. Taking the city had not proved that difficult. However, keeping the victorious rebels from burning it down was. When the rebellion's leaders had told Thera about their plan, which had been put into place at the mysterious Mother Dawn's urgency, she had seen great opportunity. Thera had never been a raider or played any political games herself, but her father had, and she'd learned much from Adaman Vane. The rebels had been smuggling men and weapons, both mundane and fortress-forged, into Chakma for months, with most of the city's garrison deployed across the region to exterminate the castless. It was an ideal time to strike a fearsome blow against the law, or so they had assured her. They intended to seize the city to use as a bargaining chip. Their plan made strategic sense, but Thera wasn't Keeta. She had no grand illusions about throwing off the chains of the capital and creating a free house where all people could live as equals. She didn't want to capture territory. She just wanted to be left alone. Only the extermination order against the castlers had changed everything. Thera had no desire to meddle in anyone else's affairs, but whenever she closed her eyes, she was still haunted by the images of those dead children on the plains. If there was a way to stop such horrors, and she didn't act, she would be every bit as cruel as the judges who'd signed the order. Thera was a pragmatic survivor, but that did not make her a coward. Mother Dawn, whatever manner of being she really was, had laid the groundwork for something impressive here. It stood to reason that if the castless genocide became too costly to continue, then the Thakur of Great House Akashan would have no choice but to call off his warriors. Losing control of the little coal town of Dakantar was one thing, but losing the valuable market city of Chakma would be a costly embarrassment. It would be difficult for him to continue dispatching Paltons to murder castless if the first was demanding all the warriors stay in their cities to protect them. The opportunity was too great to pass up. However, Thera had also seen the madness that accompanied war, especially illegal war, and didn't want to bring that hell down upon these people. The law allowed for raids and disputes between houses. In fact, that was how her father had become so rich and respected. The judges knew that low-level violence between rivals was inevitable, so the law included a code of appropriate behaviors for raiders. Stealing was fine, but needed to be kept within limits. That way, valuable trade could resume as soon as possible. No salting fields or destroying factories, for example. Death on the battlefield was expected, but torturing captives was not. So on and so forth. These rules enabled her old caste to conduct their bloody business without too much disruption to the others. They were often so good at it. She'd even heard rumors of border villages that had changed hands so many times that the worker caste who lived there didn't even know who they belonged to until it was time to pay their protection notes. When warriors weren't good at it, innocents died crops were burned, people starved, rats feasted on the fields of bodies, and plagues spread. Whenever raids threatened to spiral into full-blown house wars, the Capitol would step in and send their dreaded protectors to restore order. Thera figured the judges only cared because dead workers couldn't be taxed. As if by a miracle, Thera had been given an army. Only this army had no code of conduct. They had not been raised to understand honor between foes. Her forces consisted of the bitter and oppressed, the grudge holders, the criminals with nothing to lose, and a few she suspected simply wanted to start fires and hurt people. She had long since been forsaken by her caste, but the teachings of Adamant Vane remained. Thera would use this gift army, but she'd be damned if she'd let them run wild in the process. So when she had agreed to the rebels' plan, she had sent them back with a message. They would take the city at her signal, but afterward there would be no revenge killings, no unorganized looting of the city's storehouses. They would take prisoners, and above all, no rape. Thera had seen her husband's forces do that during the house war in Macau, and the memory still filled her with disgust and revulsion. Thera had met many rebels and fanatics over the years, and most were good people done wrong, or true believers, but very few of them were as high-minded as Keita, or as faithful as Ratul, and unfortunately, she knew many of them were simply opportunistic scum. The ones who had faith that the voice was really divine would obey, but she suspected a few would not. So, to accentuate her commands, she had warned them that anyone who failed to obey their prophet's commands would be dealt with by black-hearted Ashok himself. Though inscrutable as always, Ashok had not seemed to mind his name being used to strike fear into the disobedient. After 20 years of collecting heads for the law, he was probably used to it. Ashok dragged the criminal into the command tent by his hair. His squealing and crying annoyed Ashok, but worse, the noise interrupted Thera's meeting with the rebel leaders. Since he had been inside the walls of Chakma all day, putting out fires, sometimes literally, Ashok did not know what he had missed, but from the raised voices he'd heard through the fabric, and the angry looks he could see now, Thera had upset these men somehow. This was not a surprise to Ashok. She had a knack for infuriating people. He had simply become used to her obstinate ways. The rebels had just met her. "Ashok has returned. Please join us." Thera clearly noted he had a prisoner, but chose not to say anything about it. "We were just discussing our next move." It was plain that whatever she had declared that move to be, the rebels had not agreed with it. They had taken the city, which was quite a triumph, only they seemed angry rather than happy. There were a dozen men assembled inside their spacious stolen tent. The bodyguard Murugan was standing right beside Thera, looking extremely nervous. Among the rebels was Pankaj Akarshan, the first caste man they had met in Dekantar. When Pankaj noticed Ashok's captive, he exclaimed, "That's one of my servants. What are you doing with him?"
"Master Pankaj, please don't let them kill me,"
the criminal begged. Ashok kicked him in the stomach hard enough to send him rolling across the fine rugs.
"Be quiet. You will be judged shortly."
He turned back to the council as if he'd never been interrupted. It was plain Pankaj did not like his man being abused, but Ashok did not care.
"Why are you treating one of my servants like this?"
Thera held up one gloved hand to silence the tax collector.
"How goes it in the city?"
Ashok noted that she stopped the rebel abruptly, reflexively. She was settling into her role as a commander, but she was a stranger to the subtle manipulations of the highest caste. The young man seemed angrier at being cut off than his man being treated poorly. Thera didn't seem to notice, but the first tended to remember such slights.
It is disorderly, Prophet, he reported. The rebels bristle at the code of conduct you have set for them. Their desire for revenge has made them stupid. There have been retribution murders, looting, and arson. A riot has broken out in the market district. There have been attempts on the lives of our hostages.
What? The fools! We need those warriors so we can ransom them back to their house.
One of the rebels spoke up. He wore the insignia of some kind of high-status worker.
It's because the warriors in Chakma have been cruel, taking what's not theirs and abusing their authority. The Fonto here was an old fiend who let his men do whatever they like. My people's anger is a righteous one.
They'll have to get over it, Thera said. I need to trade hostages for the lives of the castless.
As she said that, Ashok noted that though they had provided most of the bodies to the fight, there were no castless among the rebellion's leadership. It was ironic that even among those who brazenly defied the law, they still instinctively followed its divisions. Other than Murugan, Pankaj was probably the youngest one in the tent, but he was clearly used to throwing his weight around and getting what he wanted.
If we let the warriors go, then they'll simply return to fight us again. We must execute them at once.
Pankaj was not incorrect. Except Ashok had given his word to the men he'd captured that their lives would be spared. He would not violate his oath, even one made to someone who'd be dead shortly thereafter. Having already explained the circumstances of their surrender to her, Ashok looked to their reluctant prophet.
No, Thera said, in a tone that said the matter was settled.
Before letting them go, we could cut one of their hands off at least, one of the workers suggested. That will render them useless in a fight, and the presence of so many cripples among the warriors will remind them not to trifle with us. The law will be too scared to come here.
A few of the rebels nodded in agreement. Ashok had to restrain himself from speaking out of turn. These fools did not understand that the law did not forget any trespass. They could remove the limbs from every warrior in Akushan, and there still would be hell to pay for what they had done here.
At least let us cut off their thumbs, said a rebel. Can't hold a sword without thumbs.
But Thera was having none of it.
There will be no torture. That's final.
The high-status worker spoke again, but with the tone of a sullen child.
Very well. I will tell my men to leave those prisoners alone.
Ashok did not tell the worker that his word would probably be unnecessary now, since Ashok had already killed the ringleader when he had refused to stand down. The mob had watched Ashok do it, and an example had been set. Then he'd left Toramana and his archers to watch over the prisoners just in case. He rather doubted it would be an issue again.
The rioting continues, but it is contained to one district for now. The sons are in place to keep it from spreading. The workers blame the castless for this battle. The castless seem content that they are not being exterminated, but they are afraid. Word of our refugee caravan has spread, and many of the faithful wish to join.
They cannot leave, Pankaj exclaimed. We will need them here to defend the walls if we are to hold Chakma.
I've been trying to tell you, if the warriors lay siege to this place, it will fall, Thera said, and from her exasperated tone, Ashok now knew what they had been arguing about before his arrival. They'll surround it and camp until you starve, or if they're in a hurry, they'll build siege engines and tear these feeble walls down.
That will not happen. We have proven ourselves strong. I will declare myself the rightful judge of Chakma and open negotiations with the Thakur. He will grant us autonomy.
Pankaj gestured at the workers.
Their demands about pay and working conditions will be met. The non-people will be allowed to live, and the faithful will be granted leniency so they may worship freely.
Ashok couldn't believe his ears. It turned out a first caste fanatic could be just as delusional as the lowest of the low. He tried to warn Pankaj.
Your Thakor will not agree to any of that. As long as the capital stands, the law will never abide such dissent. The protectors will come for you. They will make an example of this place.
How do you know this? Did the gods tell you?
Your gods tell me nothing. I know that it is what they will do because it is what I would have done in their place.
The gods should be guarding us, exclaimed another worker. Only we've seen no evidence this girl is the true voice. Mother Dawn told us to watch for a prophet, but all this one has done is keep us from taking what is rightfully ours and stopped us from killing those who deserve it.
When several of the leaders murmured agreement, Murrigan actually spoke up.
Don't you dare speak ill of her. She's the voice. I've heard it with my own ears.
Lies, the worker shouted.
It's the truth.
Murrigan moved his hand to the hilt of his sword.
If you want, I'll demonstrate my conviction.
The worker glared at Murrigan, but though the worker was a tall, fit man, he wasn't stupid enough to try the young bodyguard. That was wise.
I've seen it as well, Ashok stated flatly,
because even though he thought the gods were foolishness, he would not withhold truthful testimony which might aid the woman he was obligated to protect.
Thera seemed thankful for him speaking up for her, though the fanatics remained belligerent.
Then why haven't the gods spoken to us? The girl wants to go and hide in the mountains when we just conquered the jewel of the plains. Why live in a cave when every one of us here can claim our own mansion? Mother Dawn's prophecies came true, but we've seen nothing from this one. While we took the city, she was outside the walls doing nothing.
What is your name?
Murrigan asked the worker.
I am Rohit the Miller. And the man you disrespect is Ashok Vidal, 20 years a protector who once bore mighty Angruvidal, who has killed more than 1,000 men in battle, who came back from the dead to serve this woman. Whose testimony is worth more, Rohit the grain grinder or Ashok whom the gods chose?
Ashok just scowled at the bodyguard.
That description was true for the most part, though it was more the Grand Inquisitor who had put him here than the Forgotten. But he did not care for the way the sons had built him up in their heads. It still seemed inappropriate to flatter a criminal.
Enough, Murrigan. They simply don't realize that the Forgotten only speaks when he feels like it. He's a lot like Ashok in that way.
Thera said that last bit with a lighter tone that was obviously intended to break the tension and calm the belligerent leaders.
The Forgotten will make a pronouncement when he's good and ready. Until then, you may not know me, but many of you know Keita and trust him. You've heard his sermons. He's prepared a place for the rebellion to be safe. You believed him before?
Pankaj shook his head.
Chakma hasn't seen the Keeper of Names for a long time. He abandoned us. We've had to figure out things on our own, and we have, accomplishing more in the last day than Keita has in years. You can't just use his name and expect us to obey. We have claimed a position of authority here. We will not throw it away.
I think you are wrong, Thera said.
But do the gods? Rohit brings up a good point. We placed our faith in you, but what has it gained us? A way out of this death trap, Thera snapped. The rebellion has survived by hiding and using hit-and-run tactics. These walls may look safe, but so does a turtle's shell, until the bear flips it over and eats its soft belly.
Rohit was growing furious.
So you have warned, but in your own voice, not that of the gods. I've seen no vast light, no words that sound like trumpets in our head, as Keita's stories have claimed.
You say the Forgotten speaks in his own time, but our time is now, and you have offered nothing. We built an army sufficient to take a mighty city, and all you brought was a bunch of starving non-people.
Ashok knew that he and the Sons of the Black Sword had defeated more warriors than the rest of the rebels put together, even though the rebels were far more numerous. The locals had opened the gates, but without the Sons to intercept and defeat them, the organized warriors would have crushed any resistance. To say they had brought nothing was a terrible personal insult, but Ashok held his tongue.
"We got our hopes up expecting divine intervention, and instead we received a woman with a cripple's hands and a coward's heart."
Thera gasped at the brazen insult. But before she could respond, before anyone else could react, Ashok crossed the entire tent to grab Rohit by the throat. He choked the man's air off before he could utter one more disgusting lie. The other leaders all flinched and stepped away from their unfortunate comrade.
"Ashok, put him down," Thera commanded.
In his anger, he had not realized that he had lifted Rohit so that his feet were kicking a few inches above the ground. The miller's eyes were popping out of his head. His mouth was puckering as he tried to desperately inhale. He slapped futilely at Ashok's arms, but he could do nothing against the iron grip.
"Offense has been taken," Ashok growled.
It was the official challenge for a legal duel, and from the reaction of the rebels, the most frightening thing that could be uttered by a man of Ashok's dark reputation.
"Offense has not been taken," Thera insisted. "I'll decide when I am offended. He insulted me, not you. Rohit misspoke. We need to work with these people, not against them. Let him go, Ashok. Please."
"As you wish."
Ashok dropped the terrified worker on his ass. He had acted inappropriately and overstepped his bounds. It was his obligation to protect her life, not her feelings. But for some reason, the insult against her had meant far more than the one against himself. So he addressed the rebels.
"Let it be known that Thera has more courage than all of you combined. Those scars on her hands were earned fighting a battle against an evil beyond your comprehension in the graveyard of demons. If you ignored her counsel, then you are fools and will perish like fools."
Few had the sense to feel shame. The others were a combination of angry and afraid. Rohit was coughing as he crawled away. But sadly, Ashok could see that proud young Pankaj took his henchman's embarrassment personally. The young man may have been a true believer, but he also retained his caste's exaggerated sense of importance. Thera had been trying to keep the rebellion in one piece. In his anger, Ashok had unwittingly sabotaged her. Pankaj would not, could not, back down now without losing authority in front of his men. Pride had made Pankaj blind to the future, but brave in the moment.
"Enough of this. I am not some fish eater to be bullied and led around. Mother Dawn came to me. Me. She said I was special. I risked my life and my name. I organized the rebels of Chakma. I bought weapons and hid them until it was time. I have the greater force. Those who fought here today are loyal to me. I will not be disrespected and offered scraps. You forget who this city belongs to."
Ashok did not understand these fanatics. Pankaj had seemed so hopeful when they'd first arrived. Perhaps the young man had imagined the prophet would simply tell him what he wanted to hear.
"Pankaj, please reconsider," Thera began. "Let us work this out. If the Forgotten is displeased by my decisions, then I am certain he will tell me himself," Pankaj snapped. "Where is he?"
Thera's eyes narrowed dangerously. She had been trying hard to be polite, and she was an impolite contrarian by nature. There was no controlling the voice, but if she could, Ashok had no doubt she would have made it appear right then and there in order to smite these stiff-necked idiots. With their alliance falling apart, Pankaj tried to assert his dominance.
Now that Ashok's report has been given, I demand to know why my loyal man is lying there with his hands tied.
I did nothing wrong,
Pankaj's servant wailed. Ashok walked back over to him, grabbed the man roughly by his shirt, and hauled him to his knees before Thera.
He is a rapist. One of my patrols heard the screaming and found him and his men having their way with a woman they'd dragged into an alley.
The captive tried to plead his case.
She was a warrior's wife. We caught them trying to sneak out the gate in disguise. We killed the man, just as we should have. She tried to run, and we caught her.
And then they brutalized her next to her husband's dead body.
The sons had put arrows in the other participants, as per Thera's orders not to tolerate such things, but they'd not known what to do with this one, when he'd started crying about his high and mighty offers, with his pants still around his knees.
So what? Pankaj demanded. She was of lower caste and deserved it. This man is of my household. His family is wealthy and influential. He should be treated with more dignity than this.
Several of the workers gave their self-appointed ruler the side eye as he said that. There wasn't much profit in rebelling against one overbearing ruler just to trade him for a new one.
I can think of nothing more disgusting than excusing evil just because the perpetrator has important friends, Thera said. My instructions were clear. He did not heed them. For that, he deserves execution.
Ashok pulled back the captive's hair with one hand, exposing his throat as he drew a knife with the other.
No, wait, please, I beg you. I did nothing wrong.
Stop this madness at once, Pankaj said. How dare you? This man is obligated to me. He's been a loyal servant during our plots against the law. He is valuable to the rebellion and necessary for the defense of this city. I will not tolerate such an insult. You need us more than we need you. I have an army of brave men and 20 fortress rods. You have an army of refugees. Without what I bring, you have nothing.
There was an edge of anger slipping into Thera's voice.
I said my instructions were clear. You will heed my words this instant, Pankaj shouted. Kill this man, and our arrangement is finished. You will be cast out of Chekma. You will receive no further aid from us. Your sick and weak will die on the plains.
Ashok went to kill the criminal anyway, but before the killing strike was delivered, Thera said,
Ashok, wait.
Knife pressed against the rapist's neck, Ashok paused, genuinely curious. Would she back down in order to keep the rebellion unified? She met Pankaj's eyes with a cold, level gaze. Thera stared him down, unblinking.
I don't want to get blood in my new tent. Do it outside.
As you wish.
Ashok dragged the criminal across the rugs as he kicked and thrashed and wailed,
No, no, please, no!
Through the furs that served as a door and into the night. A few of the sons were standing watch. They saw their beloved general pulling the pathetic wretch along, but said nothing. Once he was far enough away to not get arterial spray on the fabric, Ashok jammed his knife beneath the rapist's ear and then yanked it out in a spurt of blood. The pathetic mewling died off as he flopped over, clawing at his wound. Ashok wiped his knife on the dying man's shirt, then left him there to water the grass.
Like us to carry the body off after he quits twitching, General? Gupta asked.
No, leave him. So as our guests depart, they can see what happens when one does not follow the rules.
Ashok reasoned it was good for the sons to see this as well. Though faithful thus far, they had been growing in numbers, and it would be good for them to be reminded the value of maintaining discipline. He sheathed his knife and went back inside. The leaders were dead silent. Pankaj was seething with rage. Thera had just folded her arms and was standing there as if daring him to complain. The only sound was a large moth beating its body against the glass of an oil lamp. After a quiet moment, Thera walked over to a small table of refreshments. As she poured herself a cup of wine, she said, "To those of you with any sense, ponder on what you wish to serve. Your god's voice, or a petulant man-child's pride?" Pankaj stomped toward the exit.
"You have until dawn to leave this city."
"And you have until I finish this drink to get out of my tent."
Thera took the drink. Chapter 20. When Devadas heard about the fall of Chakma, he rode there as fast as he could. Akashani warriors had already surrounded the city, but not yet attacked. Each time scouts had approached the walls, they had been fired upon by terrifying fortress weapons. No one had been hit, but the warriors were rightfully worried about the thunderous things, and it was unknown how many the rebels had inside. There wasn't enough good lumber around the cursed windy place to build proper siege engines to shatter the gates or smash holes in the brick walls, so the warriors had formed a perimeter to keep the rebels from escaping, and then waited. What was their plan? Were they shipping in logs or sitting around hoping for trees to grow? Perhaps they were waiting for the city to run out of food, content to let the law-abiding trapped inside starve along with the guilty. Devadas had not known nor cared what their plans were. All that mattered to him was that Ashok Vidal had been seen inside that city. He was told that a few residents had snuck over the wall to escape. When they'd been caught at the perimeter, they'd claimed that Ashok Vidal was still inside, a terrifying spectre in blackened armor who served as the vengeful right hand of the false prophet, who ruled over the city as a blood-soaked tyrant, purging all who would not obey his whims. It pained Devadas to think of his once brother, so fallen and depraved that he would now serve such a foul creature. Ashok needed to die for a multitude of reasons, but in a way Devadas suspected killing Ashok would be doing him a favor. It was time to end this. So Devadas had taken command. The Fondo in charge had been dispatched from a garrison to the south to deal with this mess, and was eager to give up responsibility for the siege. The Akashani warrior caste had been embarrassed enough already. Their Thakur, safe in distant Madarvo, would be enraged when he found out that some of his lands had been taken over by lowly fish-eaters and would need someone to curse. The Fonto was happy to let the protectors be the ones to take the blame for a while. Only Devadas was not a patient man. Word of the rebellion claiming an actual city had drawn every protector in the region like crows to a corpse pile. You did not need siege engines when you had 10 protectors at your disposal. 30 days after the city of Chakma fell to criminals, Lord Protector Devadas liberated it. The protectors crept up to the city in complete darkness with eyes like owls. Kushal and Usman scaled the wall first. They were both mountain-born, able to climb like monkeys, and that had been before they'd been given the incredible strength and dexterity that could only be bestowed by the heart. The rest of them were wearing their silver armor hidden beneath thick grey cloaks, but Kushal and Usman were dressed in nothing but dark silks, so they could make their way up the weathered brick in complete silence. At the top, they smoothly knifed the nearest sentries, then sent down ropes. Once they were atop the battlements, the protectors made their way toward the gatehouse, silently killing as they went. Just because the order normally worked in the open as a gleaming, unforgiving example of the law's ultimate authority, that didn't mean that they couldn't be stealthy when necessary. The gifts they were given by the heart of the mountain made them fearsome hunters. It could only help one thing at a time, but in turn they could sharpen their hearing, heighten their sense of smell, improve their vision,
and then give their bodies incredible power and speed. Even without the magic and the blood, they had far more experience than their foes, the finest training in the world, and a dedication that these savages could never understand. The sleepy castless manning the walls never stood a chance. Devadas took half his men down a ladder into the interior. They made it all the way to the gate before one of their victims managed to scream before dying, but by then it was too late. Shrugging out of their cloaks, they fell upon the rebels at the entrance and hacked them to pieces. Most of the rebels never even got a chance to wake up. Ranveer and Broker increased their strength so that they could move the iron crossbar that would normally take half a dozen men to lift, while far above them Kushal lit a torch and began waving it in a predetermined manner to signal the warriors it was time. The gates of Chakma were open. Not too far away, a rebel began to bang on a drum. They had made sufficient noise that the alarm had been raised. No matter. Across the distance, the plains lit up as hundreds of torches were struck. The warriors had begun their march.
"Smash the hinges so they can't close them, and let's go."
Killing criminals was always a rewarding business, but they were here for more serious matters. It was time to end Ashok's life. They made their way toward the government house, which the escapees said the false prophet had claimed as his palace. They remained together. Normally, in a situation like this, the protectors would break into smaller groups to move ahead of the less capable warriors, spreading fear and removing choice targets. But for Ashok, Devadas wanted superior numbers to make sure the job was done. It was a rare event to have this many protectors working together. Any one of them was an incredibly lethal combatant. 10 of them were concentrated destruction. They sprinted through the city in a loose knot, killing anyone who got in their way. Men rushed out of their homes ready to fight, only to be promptly sliced to ribbons by a silver blur before they even understood what was going on. Devadas had warned his men about the fortress magic that had killed Abhishek Gujara, so half of them were armed with bows. Whenever a head appeared in a window or peeked over a balcony, it was immediately struck full of arrows. Considering how fast a protector's reaction times were, they probably killed several innocent bystanders that way, but Devadas could not risk losing any more men to that despicable fortress magic. To best Mighty Angruvadal, he would need them all. There were rumors that Angruvadal had been broken, and Ashok had not used it in Niramphorn, otherwise 3 protectors would have died there instead of just 1. But Devadas was still prepared for the worst. Each of his men was ready to face the deadly fury of a black steel blade. They passed bodies impaled on stakes, surely belonging to those who had resisted the tyrant's rule. There were a great many of them, male and female, old and young, their caste unknown because they'd been stripped of their garments and their skin flogged to ribbons. This was cruelty, but it did not seem Ashok's flavour of cruelty. Their brother had done terrible things in service to the law. They all had. But he struggled to imagine Ashok lowering himself to this barbarity in the name of a false master. Such torture seemed petty. "What have you become, Ashok?" There was a semi-organized force of 20 men guarding the government house. Despite the fact they were wearing armor and carrying proper swords, they were obviously workers wearing stolen and ill-fitting gear. 2 of them had strange wooden metal poles that spewed illegal fortress death. The guards had heard the warning drums and the approaching screams, but still hadn't fully prepared themselves for an attack. Even if the walls had been breached, there should have been no way an enemy could cover this much ground so quickly. Only protectors were no normal enemy. Devadas was in the lead. Jamari Vidal was to his right. Broker Harbin to his left. As the ones with the fortress staffs were riddled with arrows,
the three lead protectors crashed into the remaining guards. The Lord Protector's sword was designed for chopping and excellent at removing limbs, so he took two arms and an ankle by the time he bounded up the steps. Certain the job would be done, he left the remainder to his men. They trained together, fought together. He had complete faith in their performance. So he leapt up the 10 steps without looking back. The government house had a heavy door made from a single piece of oak, a lavish display of wealth in a land without trees. But Devadas kicked it into splinters. He stepped inside the government house and roared,
"Face me, Ashok Vadal!"
It was a large room, probably for public meetings, only now a multitude of fanatics were camped inside. Probably the false prophet's most loyal troops. They had been woken by the alarm, but Devadas' sudden appearance still took them by surprise. The rest of the protectors rushed in behind Devadas and immediately formed a cohesive line. Devadas scanned the room, but there was no sign of their former brother.
"Kill them all!"
The line moved forward like a worker's scythe as the government house filled with blood. As Devadas killed his way across the room, he noticed a gaudy mural had been painted upon one wall. It showed a man in golden robes, preaching to an adoring crowd as a faceless, armored figure with a black sword stood behind him like a menacing shadow. It was very amateurish and looked to have been painted recently. A throne had been erected in the room, but it was empty now. There were stairs behind it, surely leading up to the regional arbiter's personal chambers and offices. As the men slaughtered the last of the nearly helpless rebels, Devadas went upstairs.
"The law is here, Ashok. It's over."
Without saying a word, Jamari and Broker were at his side again, and directly behind him were two more protectors with nocked arrows. There were several doors on this landing, but only one had a man guarding it. His armor had been stained black, and in his hands was a black sword. Devadas felt a surge of conflicting emotions, fear, anger, eagerness, and then disappointment. Because that was no Ashok. That still didn't stop his men from putting two arrows in his chest. The false Ashok crashed against the wall. Jamari cut his sword hand off, and Broker shattered his femur with a mace. The fake ancestor blade hit the floor. Devadas looked at it in disgust. He'd never forget the real Angruvadal that had forever marked his face. At times, when he closed his eyes, he could still see the searing darkness. This sword had merely been painted black. The imposter stared up at him in lip-quivering fear, and with a snarl, Devadas smote his head off. Devadas went into the arbiter's bedchamber. A young man was there, naked and thin. Three women were huddled in the corner, mostly without clothing. From the odor, they'd been smoking an obscene amount of poppy.
"I am King Pankaj, voice of the forgotten, ruler of Chakma, and I wish to negotiate..."
Devadas broke his nose with one fist. The false prophet landed on the bed and got blood all over the sheets.
"Search the place," he told his men, then turned back to the idiot.
"You can't do this. I'm of the first caste."
"Where is Ashok Vadal?"